This morning, state lawmakers are hearing bills that are a result of people being turned away from stores like Walmart as they sought shelter from a possible missile threat. The chair of the House Public Safety Committee talks about the legislation and also his reaction to the report about what really happened at the State Emergency Management Agency during what was supposed to be a drill.
I was surprised that someone, a staff member who was in a key role at emergency management and had a history dating back years of inability to perform his job, which in this case was a crucial job, was allowed to remain in that position rather than, you know, something else. That was my number one surprise. Number two was that in those crucial 38 minutes when everyone was sitting around wondering whether it was false or real or what, that at the headquarters, at the command center, no one really seemed to take control. There were a number of employees, according to the report, that were doing various things, but no one really seemed to take the bull by the horns and say, let's figure out a way to send out a false alarm message ASAP. And that, to me, was not really well-managed.
Right, so you've got 2 weak links there.
Yes.
What do you hope happens going forward?
Well, going forward, I am waiting for the report from General Hara. But in the meantime, I am going to be asking the legislature to move forward on creating a disaster preparedness task force that pulls in people from various facets of the community that really have a stake in emergencies like this. For example, the Association of Broadcasters, the tourism industry, our public schools and University of Hawaii, because number one, I would like outside eyes to take a look at the corrective actions that are being undertaken to see if they really are going to correct the situation. And number two, I think that even though we talk about restoring confidence in the emergency management agency, that it really has to be earned. And I think the way to earn it is to bring in outside eyes from our local community and have them participate in the review and participate in the actions that go forward. So I am proposing that this task force report back to the next legislature as to legislative actions that may be needed. And maybe keep it going because, you know, we're talking about nuclear missile attacks, and this is something really recent that's only popped up in the last 6 months as an emergency situation. Who knows what will happen in the next 6 months or years to come? So I think we need an ongoing working group to look at emergency situations like this.
Did you feel that the administration might have misled the public in the early days about what had transpired that morning?
Well, there seems to have been some miscommunication over what the worker, the so-called button pusher, knew at the time this all happened. I would have hoped that it would have been clarified sooner, but I can understand the responsibility of the administration to want to wait until all the facts were in as far as the investigation was involved, because, you know, it does involve personnel issues, and so those can be sensitive if not handled correctly.
There's been some talk about the software that the agency uses. What are your thoughts on that?
Well, that's another thing. You know, I know that there is some controversy over how modern and how effective the software used was, but that's why I think I'd like some outside eyes to take a look at what is the best practice in terms of other institutions using this kind of system, and, you know, what are other states doing? I know we're the forerunner in terms of issuing alerts for nuclear attacks, but every one of the other 49 states has some kind of statewide emergency system. So, you know, let's take a look at what other states are doing to see if we really are keeping up with the most modern technology.
It was interesting to see the different responses We did hear of some establishments turning people away who maybe mm-hmm. sought shelter during that time, knowing they only had maybe 15 minutes. We understand your committee is looking at a number of bills.
Yeah, we have several bills dealing with the responsibility and liability of stores and other public facilities. The gamut of proposals include proposals that stores be required to keep people in who want to stay in and to allow people in who aren't in, or subject them to penalties if they don't do that. And so the other range simply provides an exemption from liability if an establishment allows people in and something happens to them, an accident or something else. So we're going to be considering those bills. I know what people are trying to do. They want to be able to find a safe haven in a store if they're already in a store or if they're nearby a store. The trick is writing that into law.
We did talk with Mufi Hanneman, the head of the Lodging and Tourism Association, and they've polled their members. They're trying to come up with some solutions to see, you know, how, since things were probably handled kind of unevenly across the board, and what they can do better.
And that's another thing. When I talked earlier about, you know, maybe forming a task force to look at emergency situations and dealing with emergency situations, I would also include the retail merchants and Chamber of Commerce to get their input as to, you know, what really are the best practices for retail establishments in the case of not just a possible nuclear attack, but a hurricane or tsunami or every other range of possible disaster. What really should stores and hotels and other establishments be doing?
Right, when people are just trying to get out of harm's way.
Exactly, yeah.
You don't want to be turned away.
Yeah, but then, you know, when you look at it further, it also raises questions. Like, for example, what if most people think of big box stores as being a place to seek haven, but what if we're talking about a mom-and-pop store and it's already full? You know, should they be required under law to accept more people, even though it might pose a safety problem in itself? What about pets? People travel around in their cars with pets all the time. Should they also be allowed in under state law? So there are a number of questions that are a little bit more complicated than what you might think.
And so those are just the committees or the bills that your committee is going to be hearing or is looking at.
Yes.
Have you heard anything about what might be underfoot on the Senate side or in other similar subject committees?
No, I haven't heard about any other Senate bills, but my committee seems to be the first step in terms of handling all the House legislation that deals with emergency situations.
Okay. And anything else you want to share just about what state lawmakers can do, you know, to improve the situation, given knowing what we know now about mm-hmm. the shortcomings either of the agency or just people's response?
Well, the thought that I have is that I know that there are a lot of people who remain very upset, of course, what happened on January 13th. And I know that there are a number of people who want the legislature to do something, anything, to prevent this from happening again. At times like this, when there is really an emotional outcry for us to do something, is sometimes not the best time to do something just to get something done. So I'm hoping that our legislature can, you know, examine the situation calmly and, you know, really come up with something that works, not just in reaction to something, but in the interests of making our entire community safer.
That was Representative Greg Takayama, who chairs the House Public Safety Committee. He tells us that next week his committee will also take up additional bills to allow the public to take refuge in state buildings like libraries or schools in the event of an immediate threat. This is The Conversation on Hawaii Public Radio, and all week our listeners have been sharing their thoughts about whether their trust in the State Emergency Management Agency has been shaken now that we have the results of the investigative report.
Hi, this is Daniel Laraway. I'm calling from Kapahulu. Yes, I feel safe. I think there were some lessons learned the worst thing that happened already happened. The possible worst thing that could happen with this kind of system happened, which is a false alarm. And I think, you know, there's always going to be a potential for human error. But I think but I think that rather than making it more bureaucratic, I think it's just you have to take a little tiny risk of something like that happening again just in order for it to be efficient and get the word out. It seemed to work pretty well. It's just that that one guy he was messing with it, and so that's why it went wrong. That's my thoughts. Yes, I basically feel safe. Thank you.
My name is David Glickman. I'm calling from Maui. I think the biggest problem in the ballistic missile notification is the fact that right afterwards, everyone all the way up to the governor lied to us. Oh, a man pushed the wrong button. Oh, it was a change of shift and someone sat on a button. And all these other stories that came out, official stories from the officials, that were all lies. Now we find out there was a systemic problem with the employee himself, who was then not even taken out of circulation, but was continuing to work and be paid for at this agency when they knew there was problems. So I think the main problem here is the lies told to the public. That's much worse than the investigation and finding out the different truths. Thank you.
Stay with us. We'll have more of your calls later in this hour. This is The Conversation.
From a young age,
boys go to Jupiter to get more stupider. Girls,
we absorb the idea that girls and boys are inherently different. But are these differences as big as we tend to think they are? And if so, what causes them?
Gender identity really is largely socially learned.
Nature, nurture, and the divide between the sexes on the next Hidden Brain from NPR.
This evening at 7.
This is The Conversation on statewide member-supported Hawaii Public Radio. Coming up, looking at a system some say that was doomed to fail. But first, your quiz.
The highly anticipated report of the state's internal investigation into the false missile alert scare was released this past Tuesday at a press conference held in the Hawaii Emergency Management Agency's headquarters in Diamond Head. For today's backyard quiz, we're exploring the history of the crater. Created during a single brief eruption over 300,000 years ago, the landmark, also known as Leahi, covers 350 acres and is easily one of the most featured backdrops in visitors and local photographs of Waikiki Beach. In 1904, the government purchased the crater for military use. 4 years later, gun emplacements and batteries were built to house coastal artillery. If you've ever walked the famous Diamond Head Trail, you've probably seen these historic military fortifications on your way to the summit where Fire Control Station Diamond Head is situated. One of the highlights, or lowlights, depending on your point of view, is that two-thirds of the way up, there's a flight of very steep steps that go straight up to the observation point. So for today's quiz, can you tell us just how many stairs you're going to have to climb? Call 941-3689 or 877-941-3689 if you know the answer. First one to get it right will get our reusable tote bag that tells people you got it right.
Hi, I'm Buffy Cushman-Pates from SEEKS, the School for Examining Essential Questions of Sustainability. You're listening to The Conversation on member-supported Hawaii Public Radio.
Here's something you might not know.
It's a federal crime to sell a pig carcass if it has a pronounced sexual odor.
I'm Amy Scott. The story of boar taint and what it has to do with the debate over criminal justice reform. Next time on Marketplace.
This evening at 6.
We're learning more about the dysfunction at the Office of Hawaiian Affairs thanks to a story from our partners at Civil Beat. It's now time for our regular reality check. Joining us today is Anita Hofschneider. Morning, Anita.
Good morning.
Why, Where do we start with this story?
Well, it's a big one. You know, everyone should take a look at the draft audit. We posted it on our website. It really goes into a lot of detail about the various ways in which money has been mismanaged at the Office of Hawaiian Affairs.
It's amazing because I recall an audit about a decade or so ago where it mentioned the dysfunction just within the offices and the staff. But this really looks at kind of the money, follow the money.
The thing that really struck me was just the long list of expenditures by trustees and their allowances. And it's a relatively small amount of money. But what the auditors found was that trustees have, over the past few years, tripled their allowances from about $7,000 a year to $22,000. And while the money is supposed to be used on incidental expenses, it really has gone to things like fancy dinners, flight upgrades, even flights for people they know, even the medical expenses of one of their sons, legal fees to cover lawsuits between them. And so the auditors highlighted that as an example of how they're really, you know, is not enough guidelines and not enough consequences for the way this money is spent.
And I know that other state agencies have a certain, you know, rules and regs they have to follow as far as procurement. So this is a little head-scratching to me.
You know, I think that that is actually a problem, and that's something that they're really hoping to rectify. I mean, what the trustees said yesterday is that they've been aware of these problems, and that's why they called for their own more deeper dive audit, and so that they are taking them seriously.
Now, I know the Office of Hawaiian Affairs is a little dismayed because I think that what they're preparing their response to the auditor, correct?
Yes. So it's important to emphasize that this is a draft audit. This is not a final audit. It was something that we obtained, and it's something that could still be revised. I mean, it could be changed substantially depending on information that the Office of Hawaiian Affairs shares. And so people should stay tuned to see, you know, what kind of responses the OHA gives, both the trustees and the administration, and the ways in which this current draft changes compared to the final.
Right, because I'm sure other state agencies are probably looking at this saying, well, you know, you want to be fair to the agency if the auditor's investigative team questions certain things, and there really is a legitimate answer as to why, you know, their books aren't in order or spending is the way it is. Any guidance from the Ethics Commission on that or the auditor's office?
Yes. So the state auditor, you know, said that he wanted me to emphasize that this is a draft and that the draft could change substantially. And they're still waiting for responses from OHA. And so, you know, if they get a huge box of files that completely shows that some parts of the draft were wrong, then they would have to change that. And so it really is an evolving document.
And I know we've been hearing stories over the last year, little things trickling out from trustees who don't get along and are trying to discredit one or the other and raising questions about some of the contracts that were being let or some of the activities that possibly might have been undertaken under the current administrator. What can you tell us about that?
Well, you know, you're correct. OHA has long been plagued by costly infighting and criticized for its poor fiscal management. And one thing the audit pointed out was that recent lawsuits involving OHA have actually cost more than $1.7 million. And if you aren't following OHA, you might not realize that some of those lawsuits are between trustees, one trustee against another. So there is a lot more to this story.
Right. A lot of bad blood. Very unfortunate. But thank you, Anita Hofschneider. Thanks for your story, and we will be looking forward to the final audit.
Thank you for having me.
That was Nita Hofschneider from Civil Beat with today's Reality Check.
This week on Says You.
It's a well-known fact that fish can't smoke. So, at least while in the water.
You've never heard of smoked fish?
So, why would you...
For those of you who were wondering why we chose Tony as our captain, I think you've had your question answered.
A game as fast as it's fun, and everyone's a winner, says you. This evening at 6:30.
Today's program is focused on the missile alert, and all week we've been gathering comments via our talkback line from listeners. Let's hear some more of them.
Good morning. This is Bud Clifton. I'm calling from Maui, Hawaii. Yes, I got that alert, and my initial reaction was I didn't believe it.
Hi, this is Rob Kendall from Haiku. You know, it seems like there's a lot of work to be done. There was a failure in software and the hardware. There was no way to cancel the alert. There was a failure in the command structure where one person could make a decision like that with no supervisor buy-in or sign-off. And there was a failure in the personnel management department, like having someone in that position who had difficulties before. So, like I said, these guys have a lot of work to do. Aloha.
I just want to say that I feel like enough has been done, and that the guy that made the mistake and made a couple of mistakes, from what it sounds like, has been removed from that position. And I do have faith in our emergency management system. Thanks.
Hi. I just wanted to say I'm not really angry at the Hawaii Emergency Management Agency for making a mistake. In a way, I think this is a wake-up call a lot of people needed to realize that they don't have a plan and they haven't been paying attention to what to do in the case of an emergency. And that includes everyone from the governor all the way down to the average citizen. So, you know, my emphasis would be, can we solve these problems, find the gaps, and fix them?
HBR reporter Wayne Yoshioka has covered the missile alert story from the moment it happened, tracking the way officials have released information to the public. He looks at the incident and the way we were told about it as an inevitable result of the way the system was set up.
I went to both news conferences on the 13th and the 30th, and what I really characterize this as, it's a shining example of Murphy's Law. What can go wrong, did go wrong, will go wrong, and it did on January 13th. They had a National Weather Service system that they tried to cram into a ballistic missile warning system, and you had operators who had hours and weeks of advance from the National Weather Service and, you know, trying to predict hurricanes and other natural disasters. And then you put them in a position where they had to make split-second decisions on a ballistic missile launch and, you know, within 3 minutes. And that is like a system for failure. That's setting up your employees to fail. And I think that's what happened.
How far back does that establishing of a system go?
Well, it's basically a weather service system. So, you know, we're talking 1960s technology paired with computer technology into mobile apps. And it's like when you make a mistake, it's amplified, and you can make a mistake seconds faster, really fast, and you can really have a wide impact. And I think that was the basic error and flaw of that system. Now, going back, what really constituted the basis for this making this decision about a ballistic missile attack? It was in July 2017 that they decided that the adjutant general, the governor, and all the leaders that be, that we have a possible threat from North Korea of a ballistic missile attack. Possible, not probable, highly unlikely, but they made the decision, okay, we got to do something. So in November, they rolled out this plan where they used an air raid warning system, really old process, and they tried to make this into a ballistic missile alert system, and I don't think It worked. It did not work. And here you had this employee who had been counseled twice, and you know, he was really out of his element, trying to make that judgment in 3 seconds. And it's like, you know, you have set this employee up for failure. You counseled him twice, and here is this person saying, "Okay, all I have to do is listen and do what I'm told." And all he heard was, "This is not a drill," and he pressed all those buttons, and there we went.
On the 13th, the day of Wayne, the focus of all the communications we got from government in the aftermath, you know, the immediate aftermath, mm-hmm. looking for an explanation, basically, one guy messed up, we're awfully sorry, he's going to be transferred, and no harm, no foul. And then, 17 days later, we learned an awful lot more.
About the whole system that they had they had created with all these processes that really were not fail-safe. There was no way to recall the message. There was no way to send an all clear. It was like the Armageddon response. Here we go, the incoming. You got 15 minutes to seek shelter, and we're all not going to make it.
Well, the state, what you're saying is that the state and emergency management personnel had been alerted to this specific problem some months before and had been working on a plan. And yet the perception of the public on that day was that there wasn't exactly a very robust plan.
Right. They were operating under the premise that you have a 150-kiloton nuclear bomb coming to you within 15 minutes. And there really was no other recourse for you. And we had people being horrified, calling relatives on the mainland, saying goodbye. And, you know, it was a horrific experience for many people. But was it necessary? We have to go back to July 2017 when they made this decision to say that we have a ballistic missile threat, a threat that is highly unlikely, but we're going to do something, and we're going to prepare something, and we're going to have this plan ready to execute. And they not only exercised that, but they used the real message. This is not a drill in their exercises, and that set this employee up for failure.
Yeah, even with that, you know, presumably agreed upon real message, seek shelter doesn't tell you a whole lot about what you need to do. And that was what I heard when I heard it. If people were running around saying, "Seek shelter," what does that mean?
Correct. And they had tried to do this whole education process, going on to various neighborhood board meetings and trying to educate people. But when you say to someone that you've got 15 minutes and you've got to seek shelter, I mean, you know, what does a person do? And here he is. They're saying, you know, Hawaii is the only state out front preparing for this ballistic missile attack. Well, when you're out there all alone and you look around and you say, why isn't anybody else doing it? That should be a red flag that comes up to you and says, don't do this. You're going to scare a lot of people for nothing.
Do you think we're headed for meaningful reform of this system?
Well, you have to eliminate the human element. And to do that, you need a hardwired system from PACOM to the state, to the county.
Pacific Command.
Yeah, Pacific Command. And when Pacific Command presses the button, it goes automatically. No human intervention, no human interpretation, no human action required. It goes, and it's sent to everybody. And that's the system that has to be in place. You've got to remove the human element and human error.
There's still an awful lot of emphasis on this human whose name we do not know, mm-hmm. as having, you know, a personal problem of some kind, or, you know, personal problems confined to a specific employee situation. Address the problem, and you've employee, and you've addressed the problem overall. But that isn't what you're saying at all.
No, it's a leadership failure. You set up a system with a chain of events, and you do it to the weakest link. If that employee is the weakest link in your system, then you've got to make it so that person, whoever he or she is, does not fail. And if you as a leader say, you know, I need to paint four computers red and use the gray ones for exercise and tell this employee, this is for exercise and this is for real. If that's what it takes, you've got to set it up. You can't set this employee and say, sit down at this computer and do exactly what I tell you. Not exactly what I tell you, but exactly what you hear. And that's failure.
I think it was only a day or so after the 13th that we saw what the graphics display looked like.
And that would confuse anyone because basically you hit a button and that disappears and all of a sudden it says, is this what you really want to do? Well, you don't know what you really want to do because you can't see it. And that's setting up an employee for failure.
There seem to have been quite a few layers between decision makers and those who execute. Or at least that particular button pusher, or however you want to characterize.
And the supervisor, of course, standing in the hallway, you know, phoning in a message, that's really not the way to do it. The supervisor needs to be right next to the person and see what actions that person takes. If they freeze, then you've got to take corrective action. You can't just stay in the hallway and say, you know, if they press the wrong button, what's that going to do? And I think 26 exercises they did. I mean, what did they learn from all those? I don't think they learned a lot.
Well, chances are we're going to be learning a great deal more about this.
And I think they need to reevaluate their decision-making process. Going back to July 2017, why did they pick this scenario in the first place? Why? And that's the question that they need to answer.
Wayne Yoshioka is Hawaii Public Radio's political reporter, and you can find his stories at hawaiipublicradio.org.
All this hour, we've been hearing about what our listeners think about the situation, and here's what some of you said.
Hi, this is Charles calling from the Big Island. Your question was if enough is being done to address the false alarm, and I would say no, and that's because the focus, I believe, is in entirely the wrong place. The false alarm was upsetting, and I'm glad that the system is being addressed, but I'm not upset that it happened. False alarms are just one of the prices of having an alarm system, and it was an eye-opener. What I'm upset about is that it was so believable, that it was so believable. The problem that I would like to see more done about is a White House that's engaging in brinksmanship and saber-rattling. Great that the alarm system's being fixed, but can we become, again, a country that engages in diplomacy and doesn't basically dare people to bomb us? Thank you.
Hi, this is Richard from Haleiwa. The Hawaii Emergency Management definitely suffered a lack of confidence, in my opinion, because, you know, you expect the highest professionalism from people with important jobs like that. However, I would like to also say I'm really glad we have the system, and it's probably going to be improved since this mistake. Thank you.
Hello, this is Doc Ralston from Waimanalo. Mistake or not, one good thing that came out of this, I think, was that it gave everyone pause to think about how they would want to be prepared and what kind of readiness. Thank you.
Enough has been said about the false alert. It looks like it was not even an accident, but someone who should have been fired years ago. Maybe the organization needs to rethink how it handles its employees that shouldn't even be on the job. Thanks.
Yes, my name is Brian Persha. I'm calling from the island of Maui. I think it might be interesting to follow the money, find out how much, if any, patronage was involved in the employee's position, who turned out to be a really not good deal for the people of Maui and for the state of Hawaii. I was at Kanaha Beach the morning of this episode, and I watched the parents setting up for a day at the beach, hit the panic button, and their children freaking out. Now, the adults can take care of themselves, but the little children will live with this for much of their lives.
Thanks so much for your calls. If you want to tell us what you think, call our talkback line at 808-792-8217. This is The Conversation.
Aloha, this is Gavin Swain. If you like today's music, find the playlist at The Conversation on hawaiipublicradio.org.
Earlier in the show, we trekked up to the summit of Diamond Head Crater for today's backyard quiz. Created during a single brief eruption over 300,000 years ago, the landmark, also known as Leahi, covers 350 acres and is one of the most recognized backdrops in many Waikiki Beach photos. In 1904, the government purchased the crater for military use. 4 years later, gun emplacements and batteries were built to house coastal artillery. If you've ever walked the famous Diamond Head Trail, you've probably seen these historic military fortifications on your way up to the summit's observation point. The trail, with numerous switchbacks, was originally designed for mule and foot traffic. Today, there are no mules on the trail, but many hikers who have encountered a flight of very steep stairway that goes straight up 99 steps to reach the summit where Fire Control Station Diamond Head, where you can catch sweeping views of Koko Head all the way to Honolulu and Waikiki.
And Jim Metz was the winner of that. He just hiked the trail last Saturday and counted the steps. At 11:44, that's today's quiz. If you've got one for us, you can send it to talkback at hawaiipublicradio.org. And at 11:44...
Support for the Backyard Quiz comes from Achieve 3000, providing contemporary content weekly to Hawaii students designed to encourage reading and discussion as preparation for college and career. Achieve3000.com/Hawaii.
Mind-boggling. That's how many have described their reaction to the report released that showed weaknesses in our emergency broadcast system. It included the stunning revelation that the person who sent that missile alert didn't accidentally hit the button, but told investigators he thought it was a real event, and it raised questions about the software in place and apparent lack of proper management controls. We reached out to Ed Texera, former administrator of what used to be called State Civil Defense. He worked at the agency between 1926 and 2011. Texera agrees the top brass had to step down. He supports closer coordination with the Pacific Command, but doesn't think the Pentagon should take control of the alert and bypass the state agency. He believes that the button pusher may have been hired under his watch.
I value that organization very, very much. I think I still know, although I think there's been some turnover over the years, but I'm sure that maybe 50% of the people that are there were there when we first started. But anyway, so I think I may know the person, and in the 4 years that I was there, I saw no evidence. If that is a person, I saw no evidence of having a problem with distinguishing real from otherwise. Yeah.
Right, and your point about the other folks that you hired speaks to competency, that you have trust in the skills that those employees.
Absolutely. You know, and people are people. We're all people. You know, none of us are perfect, and so there was always a wrinkle here, a wrinkle there, an issue there. Somebody, wanted to maybe do something a little different with what the standing operating procedures called for. You know, just really kind of minor. And you know, the best I could do then, and I think they are still at the same little cubicle that's right next to the conference room. It's a very small space, very, very small. But it's the best we could do. Putting three people in this little watch center with flat screens and the right communications and equipment that we could field with computers and all of that. So just the routine, if you can picture people coming in on their shift, you know, every 8 to 9 hours, kicking in around the clock, for example, whether it's a 6 o'clock shift change in the morning and in the afternoon and then up at around maybe 10 o'clock or 11 o'clock at night. And you're going through that routine, you know. And so I was very concerned, by the way, that, after most of the staff went home at 5 o'clock and all that, and the shift changes would go on. And then I was always concerned about the midnight shift, that they would come on in and then they would have a real critical time period. And I was always concerned about those folks being out there. So, you know, basically they got my assurance that I was just a phone call away whenever I left that emergency operating center.
Well, you've had an opportunity to read the state report as well as what was released earlier in the day, the federal report as well. The employee has been terminated, another employee possibly suspended. Vern Miyagi has been removed, and Toby Claremont has also stepped down. Do you think that was enough? I mean, you held that position as head of that agency. Would you have stepped down?
Well, it's, you know, I've gone over that over and over again since day one and tried to tell myself that, oh, if I was still there, could the same problem or incident have occurred? And got to say, yeah, because it's a human error. It could happen to anybody. Much I struggle with is, as the agency has received new equipment, new programs, new software, you know, there's always somebody with something else that's going to be faster and easier and maybe more affordable to buy and all that. But as you feel these new devices and software and you come up with new procedures, that, you know, it's such a moving floor. You got to, as you get new things in, you got to change. You got to look at your procedures. You got to make constant changes. You got to maintain and you've got to train. And so it kind of dawned on me that would I have been smart enough to see these changes come in software and procedures and checklists and all that, would I have been smart enough to detect that perhaps it was too easy for a person to make a mistake? And would I have been smart enough, and the people around me, of course, to be smart enough to say, you know what, we just can't have one operator making all these kinds of maneuvers, if you will, on the screen. Bad word to choose, but selections on a screen, you know, perhaps we needed more control given the situation that was developing in 2017, you know, with the rhetoric going back and forth between North Korea and the Trump administration, the North Koreans testing more missiles, finally firing the Hwasong 14 with a range of about 6,000 miles on July 2017. And then, you know, with all that was going on, and looking at this particular scenario, would I have been smart enough and the people around me smart enough to say, hey, you know what, this is getting too sensitive, too dicey. We really need to put a lot of controls on the practice of these types of procedures and not leave it up to just one person on a computer and then, doing what needs to be done to sound the various alerts. That's what haunts me.
Based on what you know, as far as best practices and what we saw happened, what should happen going forward?
Well, you know, when the day it happened, I received a few calls. One from an official in Washington, D.C. that it wanted my opinion and about what had happened. And I basically talked what I just said. And I said, you know, just from what I saw in 2016, going back and working for Mayor Billy Canoy in the County of Hawaii as a civil defense administrator, I had an opportunity to reconnect with the staff of the Hawaii Emergency Management Agency. And I was the beneficiary in Hawaii County Civil Defense of the systems that were fielded. And one of the things that caught me by surprise was how easy it was to sound our sirens, at least for the County of Hawaii, and because it was the same system that all the counties have. It was very, very easy. And as a matter of fact, it was just really a touch screen, you know, to set off the sirens, cancel tone. And I welcomed the changes. I had some suggestions to make it even more protected so mistakes don't make. And I made those recommendations to the communication staff at the state level. So I saw that, you know, a lot of systems, had come into the state and the county government statewide that made the job easier. So I kind of left with that thought in the back of my mind that, you know, everything evolves and technology is going to make our jobs easier in the emergency response community. So that all said, when you take that, what I just said, as an assumption that when it came to this particular scenario for a ballistic missile strike or a ballistic missile threat, and the procedures that we need to follow, it kind of made me believe that what I witnessed and worked on when I was at the agency in state at Diamond Head Crater up through 2011 had to be something that was less cumbersome now. And reading that Oliveira report in particular told me and showed me clearly, not only was it simplified, but it was also very, very complex. And it talked about various steps and procedures and the ability or inability to keep up with the maintenance of standing operating procedures and checklists that were uniform and followed to the T and all of that. So it kind of left me with, oh, man, it's no longer simple, making it very, very hard for the watch officers and the supervisors to stay on top of things. And then I think leading to someone easily making a mistake. But, Catherine, as it turned out, we're hearing that the person that made the mistake on the computer thought it was a real missile attack. I think the person said he had heard the first message that said, exercise, 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 blah, 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 simulating the message out of U.S. Pacific Command. But the words in that particular script said, this is not a drill. Now, I don't know what the state of the mind of that employee or former employee was, and then maybe the wording, this is not a drill, may have been new, or something it clicked something in his head to think that, you know what, I blocked out the exercise, 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 and he operated on the script that says, this is not a drill. And by the way, Catherine, when I saw that on the in the media, I said, where the heck did somebody come up with this is not a drill? That smacks of what happened back on December 7th, 1941. I don't recall any kind of a message having to do with the ballistic missile threat where we had words like, this is not a drill. And the person saw that and said, well, this is not a drill, and then did not hear the end of that drill message that says, exercise, exercise, exercise. So I'm just stunned. I'm just astounded.
That was former Civil Defense Head Ed Texera. The former combat veteran has a history of emergency management with the state and Hawaii County and was talking to us from Waimea.
And that's it for today's edition of The Conversation. Up tomorrow, we'll talk with Olelo that wants Spectrum to leave community access channels alone.
And thanks to all our listeners for our calls. You can always give us feedback at 808-972-8217. You can email us at talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org. We're on Facebook at The Conversation and Twitter at HI Conversation.
If you missed any of this show or want a past one, find them on The Conversation page with links to information about guests and topics. Just look under Talk Shows for The Conversation on hawaiipublicradio.org. I'm Chris Vandercook.
And I'm Catherine Cruz. Join us tomorrow for more of The Conversation.